So my name is Miroslav Volf. I teach theology here at Yale University. I direct the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. And part of that, our effort, is a program on life worth living. In its conjunction with the program called Life Worth Living that we have with us a guest for today, a very prominent Muslim scholar and president of Zaytuna College in Northern California. Welcome.
Thank you.
Our conversation is going to be about what makes life worth living. Mm. Great philosophical traditions, but also great religions, at least it seems to me, have placed this question of the nature of human nature and human destiny at the heart of their endeavors. Would that be true of Islam?
I think that it's fundamental to the religion. There's a verse in the chapter known as the Bee, Nahl, I think it's 97th verse, where the verse says that whoever does good deeds, mm-hmm. whether male or female, and is a believer, we will bring them to life in a good life.
Mm-hmm.
And it literally says hayatan tayyiba, like a good life. So, but it's God who is bringing that life about.
Hmm.
And so the two fundamental keys to that good life are faith and deeds. And this is, you know, this was a big debate in Christianity, as you know, justification.
Of course. Yeah.
But in Islam, interestingly enough, justification is through faith alone according to the dominant, but deeds are necessary.
Hmm.
And so Then it comes to what is faith and what are good deeds.
Right. As you mentioned, this kind of debate was going on and still in some ways is going on within Christianity today, kind of various schools. So the good life or the flourishing life, life worth living, it consists of deeds. What are the deeds? What kind of agency do we need to exert to live mm-hmm. or lead a good life?
I think one of the things, for many people now in the West, I think, and around the world, I think a good life is associated with a pleasurable life.
Mm.
And certainly if you go back even to the Greek period, Aristotle's in the Nicomachean Ethics, he talks about the necessary components of a good life. Wealth is one of them, having a modicum of wealth that enables you to do what you want. And certainly we see that. It gives you a certain type of freedom. And then he talks about friendship. And he has a whole chapter on friendship, which is very interesting because to have a good life, certainly friends, it would seem, would be included in that. And he talks also about virtue and a contemplative life. And I think the 10th chapter to me is the most interesting because it's almost like he doesn't really ever get to what he's really talking. It's almost as if it's a hidden tradition that he's just hinting at in there. But for Muslims, that is the key to a truly good life, is a contemplative life. There has to be meditation on reality, and that meditation on reality by nature is going to engender good deeds.
So in Aristotle, there are these two components, right? Circumstances of life,
right.
As you mentioned, wealth, friends, maybe
health.
Political stability,
health
yeah. of a person,
sure.
plays a very significant significant role, as does the agency of human beings. So in terms of Islam, you would say the good life may be possible under all sorts of circumstances, but actually, or people may find that they can lead a responsible human life
right.
under all sorts of circumstances, but actually what we ought to strive for is to have a certain level of comfort in circumstances which make the human life possible.
In the Quran, I think it's very clear that circumstances are not necessary.
I see.
Because for instance, right now in Syria is a good example where it's incredibly war-torn. Despite that fact, there are people in the midst of that are in a state of submission. Because we can't determine our circumstances, but we can determine our responses to our circumstances. And I think that is the essential meaning. If you really, truly believe, no matter what God throws at you, like Job, you know, Ayyub in the Quran, no matter what God throws at you, you do not question God. And this, for the Muslim, this is absolutely essential. The verse in the Quran that says, God will not be asked about what he does, but you will be asked about what you do. And I think this might be a fundamental difference, certainly with the Jewish tradition and the Islamic tradition, is that that submission really is a submission. It's not to say that, you know, that God, that we can't in ourselves ask questions. It's not that, but it's a type of submission to whatever God throws at me. My response is what I'm going to be asked about.
Is that closer than, say, I think about Stoicism, that you can have a kind of circumstances, your own state of the good life or flourishing is independent of circumstances, and the goal is to make it as much independent as possible so that you can have this independence notwithstanding what surrounds you.
I think there's definitely a relationship between Islam and Stoicism. I mean, there are people that have argued that Muslims took things from the Stoics. I don't think that's a sound historical argument, but I think the Stoics... It's interesting to me that the Stoics, the two great philosophers of Stoicism, one of them was a slave and the other was an emperor. And I just find that very intriguing. Maybe
the emperor was as much of a slave as the slave, and slave was as much of an emperor as the
And I think the Stoics would definitely look at it like that. The circumstance, I didn't choose the family I came into. My family was highly educated. So that enabled me, for instance, my language skills are just going to be naturally better because I grew up listening to articulate parents. I didn't choose those.
Yeah.
So each one of us gets circumstances that we're given. But what we do with those circumstances, this is what is going to determine the merit or the mettle of our character.
But how about in Islam, there are certain... legal provisions, certain even political visions, certain economic kind of strictures that ideally ought to characterize, or we aspire for them to characterize societies, because they make devotion more likely or expression of the devotion. So that there is a creation of circumstances, or I'm asking.
That
fosters faith or something.
I think you're absolutely right that we are challenged and really in quite literally commanded by God to exert our efforts in bringing about circumstances that are going to make the good life possible. And certainly Medina is an example of that. Mecca was persecution. The Prophet fled, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, fled to Medina and set up an environment. The first thing he did was he established a free market. And what's interesting about Islam, to me, is it's the last economic religion. I mean, we know that in early Christianity, one of the major debates in early Christianity was about faith and wealth. And yet, I rarely hear Christians talking about, for instance, usury, despite the fact that it was considered a mortal sin.
Until
the 19th century, exactly. Like, you went to hell. And they wouldn't even bury usurers in Christian cemeteries. Usury is still a very vital element in Islam. I mean, very devout Muslims will not buy houses in America because they won't take the mortgages to do that. So people take that very seriously. They're very afraid of in any way violating certain aspects of commercial law in Islam. And commercial law is probably one third of the Sharia is about commercial law.
Yeah. Well, the debates about usury in Christianity, that they're motivated that every time you require interest, you put the person who has borrowed from you deeper into a hole. in many respects. And so to protect it, I think it was exactly, and still continues to be important in that regard.
Exploitation of people, also poor people. And even Calvin, if you look at when and the bankers actually erected a monument to Calvin in Geneva, I think. but when you look, even Calvin, he only allowed usury, what he called interest, with people that could afford it,
but and with, that could be productive. Rather
and it was
than simple,
and he put a cap, I think, on 3%. It was very small.
I think it's a very important discussion in general to have today, given the levels of debt in
all over the world. And debt is a form of slavery, indentured servitude.
Absolutely.
You know, even in the United States, I mean, debtors' prisons were very common in the West.
And especially poor suffer and disproportionately high.
Absolutely. I mean, payday loans, which the banks often, like Wells Fargo, Bank of America, these banks have payday loan. They also cater to that element. So, I mean, for me, I really feel like one of the fundamental rights of children is to be born debt-free.
Yeah.
And you cannot, we're $16 trillion in debt in the United States. I don't see how a good life can be sustained in this country because eventually that debt is going to fall due. And if you read, for instance, Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations, that last chapter on public debt, no civilization has survived a public debt. And you know, the other thing about a good life for me is entertainment. Because I really feel one of the humans love to be entertained, and the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam was once saw some people going to a wedding, and he said, "Is there entertainment?" And so what's called lehu, and we need respite from the world, both spiritual respite, but also just pleasurable respite from the world, and that's why singing was so important in most religious traditions. Sufis put a lot of emphasis on singing,
inshad.
One of the things that I find increasingly difficult for people in this country is the degrading nature of our entertainment culture. And I think one of the most important things to live a good life for me is human dignity. Because
you mean to have a sense of dignity, or to actually have the kinds of circumstances instantiated also in laws that would make sure that the dignity of every person is in fact preserved?
I think both.
Both.
Yeah. I think the human being, we have to see who we are. We're not animals. You know, I hear a lot of people say this interesting thing: we're just animals. You know, there's a lot of people that make that claim.
Yeah, just is the problem in this phrase.
Exactly. We are part animal,
but
we have something that clearly distinguishes us, not in kind, but actually in the genus. You know, we have an immaterial component, and despite whatever neurologists and neuroscientists say, nobody has pinpointed consciousness, and that is simply a fact. It is a biological fact. Nobody can pinpoint consciousness. We know that there's mechanisms that enable consciousness, but consciousness itself is an immaterial reality, and therefore we are, you know, the hylomorphic, if you want to use Aristotelian terms, we're body and soul.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Nasiruddin al-Tusi in his book on ethics says is when he says, first let us establish the existence of the soul. And he said, this is not a debatable point, because even the drunkard in his drunkenness, even the sleeper in his sleeping, is aware of himself.
So let's take this awareness of ourselves, whichever way we want to code it. Islam emphasizes significance of the knowledge, a knowledge primarily of God, significance of remembrance of God, significance of being conscious of God. And would it be true to say that one of the main features of our own agency vis-a-vis the good life is the knowledge of God? You mentioned earlier, from that knowledge of God, from this relationship to God, other things flow. Can you talk about what this knowledge of God means?
Knowledge of God is it. There's a knowledge of God that is theoretical.
Yeah.
In Islam, that, for instance, if you were outside of Islam, you could learn it as a theologian. So you could learn dogmatic theology in Islam. You can even learn the natural theology.
What we call doctrines.
Doctrines. Learn, you learn these
or
things.
Convictions about God.
God has no place. God is outside of time and space. Yeah. God has is simple. Mm. You know, there's no compound. He's not complex or compound.
Very similar as
very
a classical
similar. Aquinas
theistic
is
of
very
God,
close to the Islamic presentation of God. So you can learn all that. But there's another element. And this is what Ghazali said. Ultimately, faith is not doctrine.
What is faith?
Faith is something that, he said, it's something that is in the heart that can come about from being in the presence.
So Christians talk about faith, obviously faith having this cognitive component, which you just described, right? But also a faith being fundamentally trust. Fundamentally, in some sense, finding refuge in God. In some sense, finding in God a proper home for oneself.
I think that well, like I was saying, that Imam al-Ghazali said that faith can actually come into you in sitting in the presence of a sanctified being. And I'll give you an example.
But what is it that come into you? Faith can come into you. What's the faith that comes into you? Can you describe in different words the attitude, the
When the Prophet was asked what is faith, he gave the object of faith. And I think that he said faith is to believe in God. And I think that it's very difficult. I read Kenny's book when I was in, what is faith, right? I mean, there's a lot of debates about what this term means, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I think faith is, I'll give you an example. Fakhruddin al-Razi, one of the great theologians of Islam from 13th century, was walking and he had all these students behind him, and an old woman said to him, said to one of the students, "Who is that man?" He said, "That's Fakhruddin al-Razi. He has 70 proofs for the existence of God." And she said, "Why does he need proofs for the existence of God? What kind of faith is that?"
Mm.
And when Fakhruddin heard that, he said, "You should have the faith of old women."
But is that faith is she talking about, and then he also affirming, is that at the level of cognition? So this guy's got all these proofs, but need proof, but you simply intuitively assent to the existence of God. How about the idea of I seek refuge in God? I submit to God. You can have all the proofs of God's existence and then not actually.
I think the point that she was making was that there's a difference between doctrine and the reality of faith.
Yeah, yeah.
That you can have all the proofs you want, and many atheists know all the dominant proofs, philosophical proofs for the existence of God. I mean, they know the cosmological argument, the argument from design, all these things. But there's no faith. And so one of the things in the Islamic tradition is what's called tahqiq, which is realization.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I was going to give you an example of, I know somebody, Guy Eaton, who wrote a book called The Remembrance of God. Guy Eaton was a committed atheist, and he told me this. And he said that faith came into his heart after meeting a man named Martin Lings.
Mm-hmm.
And he said it was the first time he'd ever met what he felt was a truly pious human being.
Mm.
And it really had an effect on him. Another example is C.S. Lewis, who was an atheist, but when he met Chesterton, he said he was forced to reassess his entire understanding of religion because he thought it was a simpleton's belief. And when he met this incredibly brilliant man who had such profound faith, it forced him to reassess his faith. And so I think just meeting a deeply faithful person can have an impact on the human soul.
In some ways, also in the Christian tradition, saints are a much more compelling quote-unquote argument because they are tracked by their very existence. And once you find the way of life that you encounter compelling, you're pulled at the level not of cognition simply, but at the level of volition, at the level of emotion toward that. Would that be?
Dr. Wolf, I think you To me, you've hit on the crux of the issue. I think what our world lacks is sanctified people.
Yeah.
And I think in the past, one of the reasons Christianity spread so rapidly was because of these extraordinary human beings.
Mm-hmm.
That even some of the Stoics who watched the Christians being eaten by lions converted to Christianity because they felt that these were the first true Stoics that they'd ever seen.
Mm.
And I think the same is true if you study the early spread of Islam. And there's no religion that spread as rapidly as Islam in history. I mean, you can just see this in a beautiful something that was done on the internet where they showed the timelines of the spreads of the world religions. And Islam just goes like that. It's so quick in terms of the timeline. And a lot of it was these people. And my own experience in meeting the first Muslims I met that had these qualities that I hadn't seen before, and my teachers that I studied with, you know, the Hindus have something they call darshan, which is sitting, you know, in the presence of somebody who has done that work on himself, and that in sitting in that presence you can enter into a samadhi state, and I can testify to that. Mm-hmm. Truth. Mm. But those people now are actually, I think they're very hidden.
Yeah. You know what strikes me sometimes that various religions, I speak about Christian faith, it is both about how life should be lived, but it's also about judgments about what kind of life is worthy of human beings. And sometimes criteria for worthiness are more difficult to communicate simply cognitively, and so you in a sense need to be faced by either community or by a person who embodies this, and you can imagine the entire gestalt of this thing, how life might look if criteria of what measures the value of what makes judgments about values would be different, and people find it sometimes incredibly desirable and irresistible.
Right? We model.
Yeah.
I mean, this is our nature.
Yeah.
Children model. They they see, and this is why it's so important for us to be dignified. One of the things that I've noticed just in my own lifetime, and I don't know, I think Europe's a little different from America, but one of the things that I've noticed just because I'm approaching my 60th decade, and I think about when I was young, how I looked at adults. And what I find is adults today are much more childish. They dress like children. They act like children.
And children dress like adults too. Kind of the leveling between the
children.
It's
very strange. Whereas if you look, for instance, at portraits from, you know, the 15th century, 16th century, children are always addressed like little adults.
No, that's interesting.
And so this idea of becoming an adult was so important, like getting your first britches. This was a transition for kids, because they wore the shorts, but then they got pants, breeches, and this was a rite of passage, the bar mitzvah, you know, the circumcision at 7, entering into the age of discrimination. These Aboriginal peoples have these rites of passage where you enter into adulthood, and I think we have allowed for a sustained adolescence. In some ways, Western civilization, to me, is a very adolescent civilization.
Yeah.
We don't have the gravitas, the debt. The depth and weightiness. One of the things the Quran calls humans is the weighty ones.
Yeah.
That we're a weighty species, and the frivolity, even in our language, we've lost gravity in the way we speak. One of the things that historically I think was very important to people was to speak properly. Even, I mean, the wonderful Bernard Shaw's play Pygmalion, even though, it's obviously satirical, but the desire of the lower classes to speak like the upper class, this desire to, when we look at a rose, what we want to see is the beauty of the rose. The more we admire it, the closer it is to our understanding of what a rose is. Mm-hmm. We have some sense of the perfection of a rose, and that's why if it has that the closer it is to that ideal in our mind. Why do we have that ideal? And this is what I feel in our culture, the type of inversion that's happened, where beauty is scoffed and ugliness is, the fact that people buy clothes that are rags now, they wear rags, whereas people in rags always wanted to be able to afford clothes that weren't ragged.
But it's interesting. We can talk about fashion, and I'm quite interested in fashion and kind of spiritual dimensions.
There's a spiritual dimension to it. I mean, our clothes reek atheism.
That would be interesting to explore. But let me take it just slightly differently, because I think it's to the heart of what we think in terms of what one thinks about the good life. One way to conceive of it is to have these ideal, almost like ideal types or exemplars into which one aspires, right? And then the question becomes, which is a typically very modern question, is, well, what happened with my particularity in this, that I was born in this place with these kinds of gifts, with these kinds of propensities, with this kind of a body? You want to put me into some kind of a straitjacket, and you see the whole this ideal of authenticity. And in the Christian tradition, you have these two impulses, and you can see it's somebody like Scotus, where you have this general. But you have to also the emphasis on the particularity of each one of us. And Martin Luther, for instance, says, well, God calls each of us by our name, right?
Yes.
And so significant, can you talk to me a little bit about significance of my own authentic particularity?
You know, Heidegger has this concept of thrownness, that we have this, we're thrown into this world, and then we become historical products. We imbibe our culture, our ideas, mm-hmm. the way we articulate all these things, and much of it is given to us. It's not, and therefore we come into this crisis if we're reflective people, that I'm not really an authentic person. I'm just a historical product. I think one of the things for me about pre-modern cultures is that what you would find is outwardly there was a lot of conformity, but inwardly, and I've seen this because I've been in pre-modern societies, Mauritania and West Africa where I was, what I noted was they have an outward conformity, decorum, which they used to call decorum. We don't even use that word anymore. But decorum is a good Jane Austen word. You know, decorum. You know, that there's a type of comportment, the way we carry ourselves. And it's a respect for social norms, because society thrives on stability. When there's great change in society, there's always turbulence. And technology thrives on rapid change. And so this is part of the crisis that we have in the modern world, is this loss of a conformity to norms. Like cultures have norms, and they're there for a reason. But we are still individuals. And within those cultural norms, we have our own personalities. And those personalities, I think one of the things about our culture is that outwardly people are all very different, but inwardly they're actually quite vacuous and similar in a lot of ways.
That's very interesting.
And
this is kind of inward conformity, notwithstanding the emphasis, or maybe because of the emphasis of authenticity.
Yeah, I read a book on the philosophy of tattoos, and one of the chapters in there was "I ink, therefore I am," and it was this idea of wanting to be, you know. I think people feel a lot of anonymity and a desire to assert themselves. And to me, I think one of the main reasons for that, God only knows really, but I think personally, one of the problems that we have in our culture is when you don't have caregivers that are devoutly committed to children at an early age, I think children lose a sense of self. And so they spend the rest of their life trying to assert and establish that. But when they're given a lot of care, a lot of attention, a lot of love when they're young, they don't need to be attention seekers.
But also we live in a kind of market-driven culture, and often market-driven culture rather than simply market culture, which market is an important instrument. Market-driven culture often tends to have a quick rate of obsolescence because it also drives things. Yeah. The result is, I'm thinking of a phrase from Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto. Maybe I shouldn't evoke it, but I think that document is diagnostically very interesting. Everything that is solid melts into air, he says at one point, right? And it's kind of a plasticity where one doesn't have a place to stand.
Right.
You can make it up, or you can create stability with certain forms of decorum, social relations, but you can also, there's something about the relationship to the divine also that gives this stability. Is that also
I think
faith?
That's the source of weightiness.
Yeah.
I mean, without
otherwise you have unbearable lightness of
being. That's it. And no real connection, because, you know, Kierkegaard's idea that you have to at least establish one true love. You have to really understand. Hence, the relationship between man and woman was so central to these religious teachings, certainly in the Abrahamic faith. I mean, I know Christianity has an ideal of for at least the priests and the cardinals and things, an ideal of celibacy, complete and utter dedication to God. But still, it acknowledges the sacrament of marriage. This idea that this relationship of really unconditional love at best, when it's truly a relationship, that is how we're informed of love and understanding love. And that's why love is so central to the religious teachings. I mean, there's a lot of people that criticize Islam as not, I've seen this in many Christian books, you know, that it's not a love-based religion. But the reality of it is love was always identified as the highest ideal in the Islamic tradition. There were certain theologians that said you couldn't really love God because God is not of our species, and you could only truly love your own species. Ghazali says theologians say this know nothing of true religion. And this is why
I like Ghazali.
Ghazali's great. And this is why, you know, traditionally the Sufis used the divine essence in Arabic, is a feminine word. And so they used the feminine as an expression in their poetry. And Layla, what they called Layla and Selma, they used it as expression because that erotic love, that intense desire. I mean, one of the motifs that's really nice I saw last night in the church that we were at, one of the motifs in churches and mosques, and this is very intriguing, is the vine.
Yeah.
And the vine, you know, in traditional cosmology, the vine is the only willful plant. It has a type of will, but it's also got this. You know, the word in Arabic for erotic love is the same word for the binding of the vine.
Mm-hmm.
And so this idea of just falling in love with God.
Yeah.
And
we talked earlier, and I'll tie it with what you just said. I think it's a very important point. We talked earlier about a need for stability, for structures. And often people flee into artificially constructed structures that aren't good for them. So kind of rigidity of a meaning that's imposed upon them, and then flee out because they see how vapid the pleasures which have no particular meaning except satisfying my own limited desires. Presumably, I mean, I think of it in terms of in Christian faith. There's kind of unity. There needs to be unity between a meaning, which requires certain stability and certain expansion of the self to something larger than oneself, and pleasure, and some kind of emotional fulfillment, or we might say joy as well. Do you see that tension in Islam? So maybe people who like to press with the thumb down in order to create those structures and forget about I think you're right somewhere, but the pleasure that the person has in God rather than in the worldly things. On the other hand, you've got kind of empty pleasures that they lack the meaning.
Right. Well, I think pleasure is an ancient just problem. It's one of the great ideas, right? Just the whole
concept. I hope not just problem, right? You don't mean that.
Well,
sense, right?
It's a problem in that it literally becomes an idol for many people. The pursuit of pleasure is literally becomes the goal of life, the hedonist.
Yeah, sure.
And there's a lot of, I mean, I like the concept.
But that's
of,
the empty one, right?
Empty that's pleasure. Empty. And I think the problem with all pleasures is that they're temporary.
Yeah.
And that's where the
you're not referenced to something outside in a sense. You give yourself to nothing. You just take everything in.
Right. And I think in a true relationship, for instance, the relationship between a meaningful relationship with a man and a wife, the deepest pleasure is pleasuring the other. I mean, there's an incredible, and I think that's true. I have to believe that that's true in all deep, deeply intimate relations. The desire to give the other, the gift of pleasuring the other.
So unity of meaning and pleasure is in love, right?
I think it is. I think that, and this is why, you know, there's a beautiful verse in the Quran. It's actually several times. It's a very common that God is pleased with them and they are pleased with God. That this mutuality of pleasure, this idea, you know, we in our theology, there's a chapter Taftazani has. Does God experience joy? Right.
And does God?
Yes, absolutely.
One simple God and non-compound experiences joy. Tell me more about it. We have the same
of course,
idea, of course, in the
you might have gotten it from us.
No, actually, remember what Jesus said about joy in
you
heaven
know what?
When
Look,
one sinner.
These are we believe that these are revelations from the same source, and therefore they would have the same. They're going to have so much shared context, and both traditions influenced one another. That's undeniable historically, but God has given us. You know, one of the attributes of God in our tradition is laughter. It's not taken literally, but
God's laughter.
But there are hadiths of the Prophet where it says, "Your Lord laughs." Dhahika rabbuka. You know, and uses that. Some people take
scoffing
it,
way,
or
kind of rejoicing
out
way.
Of rejoicing.
Yeah, and laughing out loud. For kind of way.
For instance, no. But for instance, there's a hadith that says a saying of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. It says that God laughs at a man who is woken up for his dawn prayer by his wife. And what they say in the commentary is that he's pleased with that it brings him joy to see that,
and presumably that's the kind of element of devout life in kind of imitation of God, so that pleasure at seeing the good and beautiful and true being realized.
God, you know,
that's where the pleasure consists in.
One of the things, you know, in the lexicon in, you know, cosmos, the word cosmos, which has different meanings, but, you know, one of them is the world in Greek, but another is order, and another is decorum, right? Is decorum, and then another is moral goodness, cosmos. It has to do with moral goodness. And so this idea of, you know, these three great virtues that I think are all our tradition share of truth, goodness, and beauty, and for us it's Iman, Islam, Ihsan. Iman is the truth of God, that we are knowers by nature. In our triune nature, we're knowers and we're doers. We will things. But we're also makers. We produce things with our knowledge and our will. And we're meant to know the truth, we're meant to do the good, and we're meant to make the beautiful, to produce the beautiful. And this is why, if you look at surgical tools from the Muslim period in Andalusia, you can actually Google this, Zahrawi surgical tools, you'll see that they're all beautifully embellished. They're surgical tools, but they all had beautiful artwork on them. Why was it so important for pre-modern cultures to adorn everything? They adorned their clothes. Why was lace so important? All their buildings were adorned. Why was wainscoting so important? Why is this beautiful woodwork important? Now this functionalism of modern society, which has lost the making of beauty, what we call ihsan, it's lost, and it's something in us that's lost. I mean, one of the things, you know, we say that what is out there is inside. You know, that man is a microcosm. Imam Ali said that you think that you're an insignificant thing, and yet in you is the entire universe, that we are the microcosm. Yeah. And one of the things that I see that we're losing on the planet, we're not losing cockroaches. We're not losing rats. They're thriving. But we're losing eagles. We're losing lions and tigers and leopards. We're losing these qualities in ourself that are majestic and beautiful. And what's remaining is the foulness and the filth. And so we are ultimately, if people want to clean up the environment, they have to clean up themselves, because the environment is a reflection of what's inside of us.
Or the consequences of misplaced desire. We could go on for a very long time, but maybe this broader framework of God, who provides both the structures of meaning but also is a source of pleasure, indeed unity of meaning and pleasure in joy in the truth and the beauty and the goodness, is a good place to end. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Dr. Wolf. I really appreciate you honoring me by just inviting me, and thank you.
You're most welcome. Thank you.